John Clayton.
Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studios.
Streaming live at 710sports.com. On demand everywhere on the 710 Seattle Sports app. Now, John Clayton.
Well, kind of a big day today. Not that it's in pads, but the Seahawks go on the practice field and start to do a little bit more than just the conditioning. Again, it's the ramp-up period, and that's going to go at 1 o'clock. Chance to be out there for about an hour and 15 minutes. Chance to take a look and see. I know that you can see it streaming on Seahawks.com. I know that you can also see it on Channel 13, but it's also good to see that now the team is going. You'll start seeing the team a little bit, and of course it gets better starting on Monday because that's when the practices and pads start. There's 14 of those padded practices. So that's good. But of course, we also have a lot of breaking college news and broken college news is what's going on and who's in and who's out. So let's get into it with the five biggest stories of the day.
Number one.
We're here today to announce the Pac-12 CEO group has decided to postpone all sport competition through the end of the 2020 calendar year. This decision was made after consultation with athletics directors, our coaches, football working groups, and with the Pac-12 COVID-19 Medical Advisory Committee, who expressed concern with moving forward with contact practice. After reviewing all the data and considering the alternatives, and having already delayed the start of our season and compressed our season, the CEO group was unanimous that this decision was necessary.
Well, it was necessary, I guess, but the bad news is no Pac-12 football, no Big Ten football. Last night, they did come to a conclusion as far as the Big 12, and they're going to try to proceed. It looks like you got the big three out of the Big Five right now that's going to be in, and I guess probably the thing that really turned the tide was the information given both by doctors for the Big Ten and also the Big 12 about the heart problem that has developed in about five players around the country. Myocarditis, which of course can be very scary, and I think that's it. But of course, you look at the ACC and the SEC, their doctors say, nope, let's go ahead and try to do it. And so now we'll see the fallout from the decisions. Now, it looks like it's unanimous that all the 12 teams in the Pac-12 have agreed that they're not going to try to bolt or do anything like that. They're going to wait until 2021 to see where it's going to go. They also decided that they're going to encourage this grad students who wanted to opt out to have another year of eligibility. They wanted to try to do that. They also voted really in the Big Ten to postpone all four sports, just like the Pac-12. But nevertheless, everything can now start maybe, and as maybe, as far as competition in the two conferences on January 1st. Impacted Pac-12 athletes will continue to have their scholarships guaranteed. They're also going to be allowed to have some workouts and things of that nature. They're going to be tested for the virus, but it looks like no college football in these two conferences, and so that's big news. And now we're going to see if Nebraska is going to try to bolt from the Big Ten because they want to play football. You can kind of get the feeling that won't happen, because if they do, then they're not going to be in the Big Ten. They're going to have to go to a different type of conference. But who wants Nebraska right now? They want to play. Michigan wants to play. Ohio State wants to play. But nobody in the Pac-12 or Big Ten will have a chance to play. All sports in those two conferences have been postponed.
Number two.
An eventful day that saw the Big Ten and the Pac-12 postpone their fall football seasons ended with a little bit of optimism when the Big 12's board of directors decided Tuesday night that it was moving forward toward a fall football season. That changes the landscape a little bit, with the ACC and the SEC both watching the Big 12 closely on what it was going to do. Both of those leagues had earlier decided that they are going to continue moving forward, and the American Athletic Conference was also watching the Big 12 closely. So now you have at least four leagues that right now are committed to moving forward. The Sun Belt may join the SEC as well. That could make it five leagues in the FBS that plan to play fall football. But the Big 12's decision to continue playing certainly gives some optimism for the possibility of having college football this fall.
And still, there's going to be some decisions going to have to be made 2 weeks down the line to see where it's going to go. But the ACC, the SEC, the Big 12, they're planning to go ahead. And I think it was kind of iffy as far as the Big 12. But what they ended up doing is saying, okay, let's go ahead. And ACC and SEC, that was all predictable. Big 12, of course, moving forward with the idea that they want to try to go releasing their schedule. They just released it. And the conference is planning a 9+1 schedule. I think they're being a little bit aggressive in thinking that they're going to get a non-conference game. I think that's being a little bit too much. They're going to delay the start of the season until September 26th when the SEC is going to start. But of course, then you have the ACC. They're already set to go the first week of September. And so they're trying to make sure that they can block the NFL from getting some of those Saturday games that they'd want to flex, because you know, you have an antitrust violation if all of a sudden you have the NFL trying to step on college football. You know, that could result in a bad lawsuit and certainly damage the relationship between the NFL and colleges, and I don't think you want that to happen. But everything's going right now. Dr. Cameron Wolf, the chairman of the ACC Medical Advisory Group, told Sports Business Daily that he felt the season could be played safely, and we'll see how it goes.
Number three.
Here's the stretch and the 0-2 on the way. Swing and a pop-up. Left side of the infield coming down the third baseline. Kiner Falefa, he's there. He makes the catch, and the ball game is over. The Rangers win it tonight here in Texas. A final score of 4-2, and this series is all tied at 1-1 apiece.
Well, the bats were not there for the Mariners. They just didn't get it done on a 4-2 loss last night in Arlington, Texas. Marco Gonzalez won five innings, but he gave up four runs. He kept them in the game, but it wasn't good enough. J.P. Crawford tried to pick up another RBI in the fifth inning, as he continues to be really doing well from the leadoff spot. Another bright spot is relief pitcher Matt McGill, which, of course, is unusual to say something positive about some of the relievers, but he did strike out the side in the sixth inning, and hitters now for the season are 1-22 against him. So, series is going to conclude against the Rangers tonight at 6:05. Pre-game will begin at 5, and then you'll be able to hear it on 710 ESPN Seattle. One thing also in notes to the Mariners, they did find out that Baseball America has ranked their scouting and also ranked their minor league system as the third best. You know, it was Houston down at the bottom, believe it or not, at 29, but Tampa Bay and San Diego, they're 1-2, with the Mariners being number 3.
Number 4.
Well, the NFL has opened the door for lingering free agents to potentially find new homes. According to NFL Network's Tom Pelissero, the league has informed all 32 clubs on Tuesday that its prohibition on tryouts has been lifted, effective immediately. The prohibition had banned NFL teams from bringing players into their facilities for workouts, with a recent exception for physicals. Tuesday's change makes it possible for players who can perform well enough in a workout setting to earn a contract, and allows teams to get a closer look at intriguing players who remain available as we close in on the start of the 2020 season. Notable free agents such as edge rusher Jadeveon Clowney and defensive back Logan Ryan might finally find a place to play in 2020 as a result.
Well, you knew it was going to happen this week once the team doctors got done, you know, taking the physicals and getting all the players set up to see where they were going to be. And so now Jadeveon Clowney, others, Justin Britt, you name it, Everson Griffin, you know, they can start to make visits. But of course, it's going to be different than in past years, because you know, you come in for a workout, and right now what you have to do is go through protocol. And so that's going to be a big change, because now what could be a one-day decision now is going to take 5 days, because the way it goes, you have to go through the COVID-19 screening test, and that's a test the first day, a test the fourth day, and then you find out if you are getting a third test, and so that gives you three tests to see if you can then have the physical. And so overall, it's going to take some time to be able to get these guys going. That's why you would think that if you're bringing anybody in, you want to bring them in today. Because if you've got padded practices starting next week, you don't want the guys that you bring in that you want to sign to doing that. But each negative test must happen 24 hours before joining team activities. So what's going to happen with Jadeveon Clowney? We'll see if he makes a visit to Tampa, or not to Tampa, but to Tennessee. So far, nothing scheduled.
Number 5.
Still on a point. Across to Kucherov with a shot blocked by Savard. Now Kucherov fires again, hit Gavrikov up high. Another chance of point, scores! Braden Point ends it! And the Tampa Bay Lightning take an epic game one in 5 overtimes.
Wow, what a hockey game. The Tampa Bay Lightning defeated the Columbus Blue Jackets in 5 overtimes. Can you believe that? You know, center Braden Point was scored the game-winning goal 10 minutes and 27 seconds into the 5th overtime. It was a 3-2 win in Game 1 of the playoff series. And so it's the 4th longest playoff game in NHL history, so long as that the Bruins and the Hurricanes now are scheduled to meet and rescheduled this morning. It's just amazing to see. The Blue Jackets goalie made 85 saves, which, of course, is an NHL record. Both teams combined for 151 shots on goal, and that's after five overtimes. It went into the fifth overtime before you got the victory by the Tampa Bay Lightning. Hey, you can listen to the show on the 710 Sports app. It's powered by the Dubin Law Group. Coming up next, we go under further review and talk about how important is this year for Pete Carroll. Is it the most important? It's the John Clayton Show on 710 ESPN Seattle.
Under further review with John Clayton.
We'll review the play.
Well, as you start the practices and, of course, the little bit of more of the ramping up period, everybody now starts thinking about, okay, what is going to be the outcome of this season? And, of course, then you start to make some, you know, bold decisions and bold judgments and all that stuff. And I think one of the topics that keeps coming up right now is that how critical is this year going to be for Pete Carroll? As you go back and start to look at the history since he's come to the team in 2010, where would you rank the importance of this year for Pete Carroll? I have a little bit of a different opinion, I think, than most, but let's hear what we find from Danny and Gallant.
I think that this is the season where the Seahawks, the outcome of this season, there's more on the line of the outcome of this season than any year in Pete Carroll's history.
Wow.
And I realize that that might be, that sounds like an overstatement. This is a team that's been favored to win a Super Bowl. In 2013, they had Super Bowl or bust expectations. They've been defending Super Bowl champions. They've come off a back-to-back Super Bowl experiences, and the external expectations are not that high for this team. The reason I think there's more on the line for this team this year is because if they're not great this season, I have a hard time seeing how they get great in the near future. The acquisition of Jamal Adams significantly raised the stakes on this year. It said that, hey, we think if we go get this absolute dreadnought destroyer of a safety, we get this top-tier defense, we think he's the piece that puts us over the top. In a competitive division, they did not play the long game. The long game is, hey, we're going to get incrementally better. We added depth in free agency. We'll see which of those guys fit. We still have resources going forward. Incrementally better is not we're going to trade our two first-round draft picks over the next 2 years, plus not to mention a third-round pick next season because we got a chance to get this guy. If they're not great this season, I have a hard time seeing how they get great in the near future.
Boy, I couldn't disagree more. And the reason I say that, it's like, okay, that's just looking at this year and not looking at the future. And the future right now favors Seattle more than it does most of the playoff teams in the NFC. And the reason I say that is that, okay, the Seahawks right now in decent cap shape, and I think Super Bowl or bust is so wrong to think about it. Yeah, they're gearing up to go to the Super Bowl. They're trying to pass the San Francisco 49ers as far as talent. My guess is pretty soon they're going to add one or two more defensive linemen, whether it's going to be Damon Snacks, Harrison, or Everson Griffin. But where you're only looking at this year, that's where the mistake is being made. You also have to look at next year. And why do I say next year? Because it's going to be one of the more dramatic changes that you're going to see in the salary cap era, in the standpoint that, hey, it's tough when you don't have an increase in the cap. We watched that in 2011 to 2012 and went from 120 million to 120.3. But now you're talking about a floor of $175 million. And, you know, unless there's going to be more revenue coming in, you know, then you have to really be in a tough spot. That's like, for example, I mean, you can say goodbye right now to the New Orleans Saints. This is win or bust for them, because next year, you know, they have to see if Drew Brees is going to come back. But if he comes back, he has a high cap number. If he's retiring, going into broadcasting, that's $23 million of cap room. And of course, they're already 60 million dollars over the cap. The Philadelphia Eagles, $91 million over the cap. Then you've got San Francisco. Basically, it's going to be almost half their 53-man roster is going to be free agents at the end of the year, including their top three cornerbacks, including George Kittle, and including, you know, a lot of other top players. Their offensive line is going to have to be scrapped. They are in tough shape. And so why I say this year and next year, it's a two-year window where the importance is going to be. If you don't get it this year, you don't go pout and, you know, say, oh, boy, this is all over here. No, next year, because you look at the Seahawks and what they have in free agency, okay, they've got, they got enough room right now. Certainly a lot of some of the older veterans in the team may not be back to KJ Wrights, and we'll see about some of the other guys that, you know, Bruce Irvin, whether he's going to be coming back and all that stuff. But what you also have is that, you know, the main free agents are going to be Chris Carson, you know, Quentin Dunbar, Shaquille Griffin. Maybe you can get one of those two signed or franchised, and maybe you can get Chris Carson franchised because the franchise number is coming down. And so the Seahawks will lose less talent than most of the other playoff teams in the NFC. Green Bay, they're tight against the cap coming up. You've got Dallas. I mean, they're going to be obliterated by the cap and have to start breaking into it. So DJ Wilder is filling in for Curtis Rogers running this show today. It's like, I couldn't disagree more. It's like, the most important year, I thought, was 2012 for Pete Carroll to get this team to be a playoff team that can win, finding out that Russell Wilson can do that. Then, of course, trying to come back in 2014 after going to the Super Bowl, which is tough to do, and they were one play away from winning that one. Those are the important years, and so it's like to put it all on this year is so wrong.
See, yeah, 2012 was an important year, but how I put 2020 is I kind of think this is a 2012-type year. You 2 years now, you've gone to the divisional round, and you've lost, and people think maybe they should have gone farther. They probably could have gone farther if they didn't have so many injuries, especially to their running backs, Chris Carson, Rashad Penny. Yes. But I really see this 2020 year as as 2012 as well, just because a Jamal Adams trade really shows, okay, we think we're right there. We think we are a piece or two away from really contending for a Super Bowl. And especially on the defensive side, where they've really struggled in the last 2 years, especially last year, where really wherever they ranked in any defensive statistic, it was the worst that Pete Carroll team has done on defense. I agree with Danny in the sense that I think this year is important because not just the Jamal Adams trade, but you're really relying on your second year players to really step up. You need like Marquise Blair to find a way onto the field consistently. You need LJ Collier to find a way onto the field. You need guys like that to really start to flourish. Could Cody Barton start or maybe even be a viable backup? Like, just guys like this, you need people to step up. So I agree with Danny that this year is very important because really you don't have the draft resources for the next 2 years to really get those impact players in the first round or even a third round next year.
Yeah, but where I disagree is that you want to win now, and so the young players may not necessarily get on the field. You know, it could be that Jordan Brooks could beat out Cody Barton, and he'll play. Right now, when you've got the secondary as talented at safety as it is there going to be a spot for Marquise Blair? Because remember, what can end up happening is that next year, you know, if Marquise Blair still might not be able to get out there and play if you've got Quandre Diggs and Jamal Adams doing so well. But I think you don't worry as much about, you know, you want to get playing time for the 219 guys, but you also know that these guys are talented enough to be able to start if necessary. But they don't necessarily have to start. I mean, you've got the deepest secondary in Seahawk history in the sense that you have those three guys and Trey Flowers from 2019 draft, you know, Trey Flowers and, you know, Ugo Amadi, and also certainly Marquise Blair. They're still there. And then you've got a large number of pass rushers that you can use that are young, and you know, you can still make trades and things like that if necessary to get more draft choices. But again, it's an important year, no question, but I think it's more an important 2 years, because now you're right about the draft choice problems of the future. You know, with only about what, 5-6 draft choices left next year, it's going to be tight, particularly without first-round picks in the next 2 years. But if you do a good job, and because remember, the one thing is, if you have some cap room, like John Snyder always likes to have, I mean, you can make some acquisitions that can fix things.
I agree, but the thing is that so for me, this rookie class, outside of maybe Jordan Brooks, I don't have expectations for them. That's nothing against them as a person, that's nothing against them as players, but just because of this whole time that we're living in, I just don't see how they're going to be able to get on the field without really a proper training camp, without a proper preseason. I think the lack of draft picks the next 2 years, mainly really next year, could be a problem if these second year or these soon to be third year players don't really start to flourish. I mean, we've seen, of course, Will Disley make a great impact on the game when he's been healthy, but can he stay healthy? We know what DK Metcalf can do. He might have another step to take, but we already know what he's capable of. But I just look at guys like Marquise Blair, like Cody Barton, Ugo Amadi. You know, I don't. They need those guys to step up, because then if they don't either win a division this year or even make to the NFC Championship this year with this team, and those guys don't really play a role in any of their games, this could be a problem with the lack of draft picks that they have next 2 years.
But DJ, is it more the development of young players or winning? That's what I think is, because, hey, if they don't have the opportunity to step up, if they don't get the playing time, is winning more important or being able to develop players? They develop players. I mean, you've seen that all through the years. I mean, they can take fifth-round picks and make them Pro Bowlers, particularly on defense. And you can see there's a lot more new talent on this team. You know, is it a matter that you want to just win, or is it a matter you want to develop talent? You want to win.
I agree. Of course, winning is the most important aspect of football, but I think for them to climb from a 10-win team to an 11-plus win team, you want them to be a 12- and 13-win team. They really need these guys to step up, especially on the defensive line, like an LJ Collier, because right now, I mean, nothing against Benson Mayo and Bruce Irvin. I mean, we know what we're going to get from them, but they need someone else to step up, someone like an LJ Collier. So, and a Marquise Blair could help in the secondary if he's able to play in the nickel, or Ugo Amadi if he can play in the nickel. Of course, winning is the most important part of the game, but to me, they need these younger players to step up if they want to leapfrog into that 12-win, 13-win conversation.
Yeah, well, I agree with you. I mean, it's 2012 was such an important year, because that's the one that I think was the most important year for Pete Carroll, and then also coming back in 2014, you know, after going to the Super Bowl. Hey, tell your smart speaker to play 710 ESPN Seattle. Remember, you can always listen to 710 on your smart speaker or app. Coming up next is our Wednesdays with Dave Wyman. It's the John Clayton Show, 710 ESPN Seattle.
You're listening to The Professor, John Clayton.
Live from the Alaska Airlines Studios.
Streaming through the 710 Sports app and on 710sports.com.
And waiting for Dave Wyman to join us here and talk about what's going to be today's the first, not padded practice, but it's going to be the first ramped up practice where at least the helmets are going to be on, no contact or anything of that nature. But it is going to be, you know, a little bit more football, which of course is a very good thing, and kind of getting a gauge where this team is as far as, you know, the talent and all the stuff and what's going to be necessary. But it's going to be an interesting day today. And of course, it's interesting around the National Football League as they kind of wait to see how things are going to ramp up. And, you know, Kansas City and Houston's a couple days ahead because they've got the Thursday night game. But overall, I think you can see that, you know, more football. And I guess one of the positive things is that, you know, the people with the positive tests are all mostly coming back, where there's about 107 tests that have been positive, including that includes the false positive of John Ursua. We're literally down to maybe less than 30 players that aren't going to be able to practice or do something. Now, there's a interesting thing that's going on right now as far as John Ross, the former UW wide receiver. Now, he's on the list, but not because he tested positive. Unfortunately, his wife and child ended up getting the virus, and so he had to fly all the way to California and try to be with them, and so they don't know when he's going to be back. So but it's been positive in that story, and certainly it's been positive as far as the you know, what you can see from the Seahawks. And again, the fact that most of the guys are going to be out there on the field today has to be a good thing. So DJ Wilder, I know, was trying to get a hold of Dave Wyman.
Oh, Dave is here, John.
Oh, he is? Oh, good. Okay, I didn't know. So Dave Wyman joining us here. So Dave, one of the big debates, I guess, started today was putting an importance on this year for Pete Carroll. And I know that Danny O'Neill says this is maybe the most important year for Pete Carroll, and I disagree, because I think the most important year had to be 2012 to establish this team as a regular playoff team. That was the most important. And then trying to come back after the Super Bowl win over Denver, you know, getting into the point where they're one play away from winning the next Super Bowl. But this is an important year. But the reason I say it's not the most important year, because I think it's the most important two-year window, because you ramped up, you want to try to win, you want to get over the 49ers, but next year, that's where it even gets in more interesting, in the standpoint that, you know, that teams in this division who are really at the cap and a low cap are going to be in more trouble than Seattle, and you're going to be able to make up on a lot of teams that may not make the playoffs who have been playoff teams in the NFC for the last couple of years.
Yeah, I guess I would sort of disagree with Danny on that. I mean, I don't think that there's the sense of urgency. Look, they won 12 games last year. I mean, they were 11-5, and they went 1-1 in the playoffs. So, and they did it with some very key injuries. I mean, look, it's when you lose Chris Carson, Rashad Penny, I mean, that was, you know, that was really bad. And Procise as well. So I just feel like it's one of those years that it's, you know, it's important that the defense bounces back. But, you know, the offense looks pretty good. And, yeah, I don't feel like – I think there's a lot of people lately that have been kind of pushing the panic button just in general on the Seahawks. And, you know, it, the way we talk about them and some of the texts that we get, it's like we're talking about a team that just went 8-8 or 9-7. I mean, this is a team that, again, won 12 games. And so I feel like they're very much in a sweet spot right now. And then with the moves that John Schneider has made, getting Dunbar, which is just the biggest upset ever in sports history, that he looks like he's going to be able to play after everything we heard, getting Jamal Adams. And then, you know, now you don't really have to rely that much on guys like Marquise Blair and LJ Collier and Rasheem Green to take that huge next step. I think they will, but it's going to be an incredibly competitive roster. So, you know, now all of a sudden it looks really crowded in the defensive backfield. So, you know, that to me, I guess I don't feel the urgency or, you know, the importance. I mean, I think, yeah, they got to try to find a way to knock the bully on the block now off of his pedestal, and that's the Niners right now. So, and they were really close to beating him twice last year. So, yeah, it's important, but I don't think it's the most important. I would agree with you. 2012, after having, remember how many, they made some ridiculous number of transactions in those first couple of years.
Well, I think, what was it, and, like 214 or 200 in the first year in 2010? Yeah.
Yep, yeah, and so, you know, that was really important that they developed those guys. And then remember, they had the two picks that were in the top 15. They got Earl and Russell Okung. So, you know, and those guys certainly worked out. So, yeah, that was a really important year. And, you know, and then getting Russell developed and everything. So, yeah, I feel like the window, especially for Russell, you know, and I don't know about Pete and how long he wants to coach, but, you know, I just think Schneider has always made really good moves and been very aggressive. And then, you know, Pete Carroll, as long as he wants to, I mean, I always refer to him as the youngest coach in the NFL. Well, fact is he's the oldest, but the way he runs practice, the way he runs his team, I feel like he's still got a, you know, a window wide open. And the same thing with Russ, who's never missed a snap in 8 years. So, yeah, it's every year is important. I think if you ask the coaches, they'd say every year it's a must win, you know. So it's just like when you ask players, like, this is a contract year, you know, they're going to play a lot harder. I remember Luke Wilson one time said something that I could totally relate to. He said, I feel like every year is a contract year. So, and I felt that way too, no matter where I was. So, yeah, it's always an urgency to win. It's always important. And, yeah, I think this might be one of the bigger mysteries as far as an offseason goes. There's lots of guys that need to take that step in the last three drafts. They need to take that step to prove that they can be the next Legion of Boom or, you know, Marshawn Lynch or whatever. But I don't know about, I mean, if they happen to go 9-7, I mean, I don't think that Pete Carroll, you know, is on the chopping block, him and John Schneider.
No, not at all, particularly when you know that next year you need as much stability as you can if the cap's going down, and you need to, because if not, then you're going to be trying to rebuild, and that's what you can see the problem. For, I mean, what I can, even though I think that they've done a better job of, you know, drafting in San Francisco, and certainly a better job of not ramping it up too much in San Francisco as opposed to the Rams, what I can see is that the 49ers are in trouble next year because they're within a $2 million above the cap or below the cap right now, but they have to sign George Kittle. Their top three cornerbacks are up. Their Solomon Thomas is up, and, you know, they're going to have to start breaking up that offensive line. They have to pay their left tackle, Trent Williams, and you look at all the 20-some free agents they have, they've got a, they're going to come out less talented next year than this year. Where you look at Seattle, yeah, they've got a couple guys that they can re-sign, but they've got more cap room, more flexibility, and actually some better young players like from that 2019 draft.
Yeah, well, and also welcome to the world where you pick at the bottom of every round all of a sudden, you know, for Kyle Shanahan and John Lynch. I mean, look, they've benefited 3 years in a row having, what, they have the second pick, the third pick, and the ninth pick or something like that. Yeah. I mean, yeah, this is going to be a lot different. And, you know, we'll see how they do drafting players because, you know, as you know, I know there's a lot of people, I think John Schneider's one of them, that, you know, they believe there are really only 15 first round grade players. So once you get into the back half, and also how about now all of a sudden the trade for Jamal Adams with what's going on in college football, it's going to be, you know, I always say the draft is a crapshoot outside of, you know, the first 15 picks. But now it's really going to be that way. If there's no college football season, now all of a sudden John trading away those, you know, first rounders is going to look pretty good. And really, you know, I've believed and contend that Marquise Blair was going to be part of that trade. Like, I feel like the Jets asked for him, but they kept him. And so basically they said he was more valuable than a first round draft choice in 2022 is the way I look at it. So, but yeah, it's a little bit more difficult when you start winning, when you've been consistently winning. And if you look at the other franchises that have done this, it's New Orleans, it's Baltimore, you know, it's Green Bay, it's certainly the Patriots. And, you know, for the job that they've done drafting players in those spots, they've been able to win through it. So, yeah, I think there's a lot of overreacting this year. I'm not saying Danny's overreacting. He might be right. But, I feel like, hey, come on, guys, let's take a breath here. They were 11-5. They were about, 6 inches from beating the Niners and being the NFC West champions and hosting.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that they still managed to win 12 games last year in what was a not good defense at the very bottom third in almost every category except takeaways, and an offense that was decimated by injuries. And I think that's not too strong of a word. I mean, with Will Dissly especially, he was my fifth most important player, by the way, John, that I pick. I think he's a top five player if he's healthy. And then, you know, Chris Carson, who I had at number four, you know, he gets injured. So, yeah, it was still a really good coaching job by Pete Carroll last year. Really good. Maybe it'll be his best.
Dave Wyman, great stuff. Looking forward to talking to you at four.
Sorry I was late, John, but I'll talk to you later.
All right, sounds good. Hey, Seahawks training camp is here, and it's time for Two-A-Days on 710 ESPN Seattle. Starting August 5th, or August 17th, starting on Monday, join us each weekday for exclusive access to training camp with a daily roundtable from 11 a.m. to noon featuring myself, our Seahawks experts, and then we'll take your chance to interact with 710 hosts on a live video chat each afternoon at 710sports.com. 710 ESPN Seattle is your all-access pass to Seahawks training camp with Two-A-Days starting August 17th. Coming up next, we get into what happened in the last 24 hours with the Big Ten and the Pac-12. Mike Yam joins us from the Pac-12 Network next. It's the John Clayton Show, 710 ESPN Seattle.
You're listening to The Professor, John Clayton.
Live from the Alaska Airlines Studios.
Streaming through the 710 Sports app and on 710sports.com.
Well, it's been turbulent in college football, certainly now with the Pac-12 and the Big Ten stepping out for this year, ACC, Big 12, and SEC advancing. And joining us right now, Michael Yam from the Pac-12 Network. And I'm sure that as disappointing as this decision was, how understanding is it what the Pac-12 and the Big Ten did?
John, great to be with you. And you're right, it's been a crazy couple days here. Look, I don't think we should be all that surprised. I mean, the rumors were swirling over the weekend that the Big Ten was going to make their decision, and immediately the Pac-12 was linked to it. If I will be honest with you, I didn't think that they were going to cancel fall sports yesterday in their announcement. I thought it was going to be, let's kick the can down the road and push this thing a few more weeks. And we built this in, I thought, was going to be the message. We built this into the schedule release with the first 2 weeks being flexible. So a little surprised by the decision, coupled with now the Big 12 making the announcement. announcement that they're going to move ahead and move forward with their decision to play and increase testing protocol for their student athletes. So I think big picture surprise, but you know, I talked to Ray Anderson, the athletic director at ASU this morning, and he pointed to the medical data that he was supplied along with the rest of the Pac-12 brass that indicated that there are some heart issues that are related to COVID-19. And reading between the lines, I think that was the tipping point of why this decision was made.
Yeah, I can see that. But the thing is that this is the, I mean, it seems like the this is the first we've heard of this. And I watch CNN yeah. and all the news channels every day,
oh, yeah.
and nobody's brought up the myocarditis.
Yeah, no, I'm with you, John. I mean, it sounds like the two of us are a little bit of news junkies along with the sports junkies that we are. And you're right, I hadn't heard much of this. And it's been something that's been evolving, I'd say, over the last week or so. I've heard more about it. But you're right, I think the one thing, John, that struck me, it's one thing to have this heart issue linked to COVID-19. When you look at student athletes, everyone is pointed to the fact that they're not in the high risk group. So you're less concerned about dramatic effects, although while still possible for a lot of these people that are in that 18 to 20, 21 year old range, the fact that asymptomatic positive individuals with COVID-19 were still suffering from that inflamed heart issue, I think that's really where that red flag came. And not for nothing, Kevin Warren made reference to it, the Big Ten commissioner, that I think five of their student athletes had had that. So I think when you look long term, it's the conservative approach. It's the harder decision to make. But in some ways, John, and I'm disappointed, I'm actually heartbroken that there's not going to be a football season in the fall with the Pac-12. I almost applaud the league, and it feels weird to even say that because I would have preferred them to kick the can down the road. But the financial ramifications are so significant for a lot of these universities, not just in the league, but nationwide. And for them to take this stand, it makes me feel like, yeah, the health and safety of the student athlete really is first and foremost the biggest concern.
Oh, yeah, no doubt about it. Now, what are the doctors not seeing from these heart issues in the ACC, the SEC,
oh, yeah.
and the Big 12?
John, I've been asking that for the last, 24 hours or so. How is it that of medical advisory boards in two of the Power Five, so the Big Ten and the Pac-12, those medical experts say it's not safe to go out there and play football? Those medical advisory boards from each conference are running independently, but they are in communication with each other on a weekly basis over these last few months. How is it that medical experts in two of the Power Five conferences say not safe and the other three haven't come up with that same conclusion? To me, it screams, John, and I know I was on with you a couple weeks ago and probably made the same point. The fact that there's no leader at the top of college football is a complete embarrassment. There's such a lack of unity from the simple task of how do we care for our student athletes on these campuses from a testing standpoint alone versus, hey, like, what are we doing with NIL? What are we doing with the signing day period now? How are we going to honor these scholarships if we're not playing? I mean, there's so many questions, and right now there's less answers, which is really unfortunate.
It really is, and it's just a very strange situation all the way through. Now, do you see Nebraska bolting from the Big Ten?
No. I mean, I think even, I touched on the financial ramifications of it. John, I'm not necessarily a media television rights expert, but my understanding of Nebraska leaving the conference, even if it was for the year, there's some significant financial ramifications in terms of television dollars with the deal that the Big Ten Network and Fox have with that conference. So I don't know if it's even feasible for them to go and do it. It's great fodder for the shows that we work on, and maybe there's some legal issues that there's some wiggle room for something like that. I don't know if it's possible. And John, I'll take it a step further. As much as we want to say that the Big 12 and the SEC and the ACC are going to be able to play, I don't know if there's a college football season this year. Big 10 and Pac-12 made the announcement on a non-conference only schedule weeks ago. And it seemed like the SEC was not going to touch that. The Big 12 wasn't going to touch that, or the ACC. And here it is. They basically, all the Power Fives went with the non-conference schedule minus the Big 12 and the ACC with that plus one model. But essentially, we all netted out at the same thing. And maybe this is just delaying the inevitable by seeing the Big 12 say, hey, we're just going to test for some of these hard issues, and we're going to test our student athletes three times a week. Maybe that's enough. And I hope it is, but I don't know how realistic that is. How do you say to a kid's parents, John, in on the West Coast, hey, you can't play on your team in the Pac-12 or in the Big 10, but over in the SEC, ACC, and Big 12, it's healthy enough for them to play? I understand variance in the country with COVID. It feels weird to me that would be the decision that those leagues would make.
Yeah, and that's what I'm also looking at, is that, you talk about the tests and all that stuff. If you're in Los Angeles and you're in Arizona, my understanding is now sometimes it's taking as much as maybe, 12 days, 7 days to get your test back. And it's like now, they want to test three times a week, if not more. And are you going to get the test back in time and all that stuff? I mean, that's an issue.
Yeah. Well, John, look, here's the one thing that I also wish that the Big Ten and Pac-12 waited for. And I know I'm kind of talking out of both sides of my mouth here, but if this rapid test, because you just brought up getting those test results, if the rapid test becomes perfective, and I know that there's some incidents and a high incident rate where there's false negatives and false positives being reported, but if this saliva test that gets you a result within 10 or 15 minutes becomes a real viable option, then all of a sudden you say, well, maybe you can go and play. And I know these leagues have all made the case that it's safer for their student athletes on these campuses than at home. I agree to a certain point. The one factor in my mind, John, that makes it safer is the availability of testing on these campuses. Those student athletes are going to be tested more than general population out there, especially as, and you've seen the lines on the news coverage, and sometimes up to 2 weeks to get those test results. I don't know if that was going to happen for student athletes in the Pac-12 conference, which to me did make a legit argument. Hey, you're going to be safer then on those campuses because of your availability of testing and knowing. And those rapid tests, I think, could potentially be a game changer for the other three leagues whose seasons are still in play.
No question. Hey, Mike Yam, thank you so much for joining us from the Pac-12 Network. And these are crazy times, so keep chasing down the stories.
For sure. Thanks again for the invite, John.
All right, thank you. Hey, be sure to check out the Professor's Notes on 710sports.com. The Professor's Notes are brought to you by Infinity of Tacoma at 5. Coming up next, Four Downs with Sean Salisbury.